Get the doctor, the nurse said. She disappeared. Daniel stroked my hair. What is it, babe? Are you in pain? I licked my lips. Asshole, I said, but it came out all garbled, and I wasn't sure he got the drift. I vowed in that moment to get well enough to throw him out. I closed my eyes. I remembered the flash, the deafening bang, Olive flying past me like a mannequin. She had looked unreal, arms crooked, legs askew, as lumpen as a sandbag flung through the air, landing with a sodden thump. Olive must be dead. There wasn't any way to mend the parts of her turned inside out by the blast. I remembered Terry with the blood gushing down his face. Was he dead, too? I looked at Daniel, wondering how bad it was. Daniel sensed my question. You're fine, Kin. Everything's okay. You're in the hospital, and Terry's here, too, he said. And, after a hesitation, Olive didn't make it. I closed my eyes again, hoping he'd go away. I concentrated on my various body parts, hoping that all of them could be accounted for. Many treasured portions of my anatomy hurt. I thought at first I was in some sort of bed restraint, but it turned out to be an immobilizing combination of bruises, whiplash, IV fluids, painkillers, and pressure dressings on the areas where I had suffered burns. Given the fact that I'd been standing 10 feet away from Olive, my injuries turned out to be miraculously insignificant. Contusions and abrasions, mild concussion, superficial burns on my extremities. I'd been hospitalized primarily for shock. I was still confused about what had happened, but it didn't take a 160 IQ to figure out that something had gone boom in a big way. A gas explosion, more likely a bomb. The sound and the impact were both characteristic of low explosives. I know now, because I looked it up, that low explosives have velocities of 3,300 feet per second, which is much faster than the average person tends to move. That short trip from Olive's front porch to the tree base was as close to free flight as I was ever going to get. The doctor came in. She was a plain woman with a good face, and sense enough to ask Daniel to leave the room while she examined me. I liked her because she didn't lapse into a slack-jawed stupor at the sight of him. I watched her, as trusting as a child, while she checked my vital signs. She must have been in her late 30s, with haphazard hair, no makeup, gray eyes that poured out compassion and intelligence. She held my hand, lacing her cool fingers through mine. How are you feeling? Tears welled up. I saw my mother's face superimposed on hers, and I was 4 again, throat raw from a tonsillectomy. I'd forgotten what it was like to experience the warmth radiated by those who tend the sick. I was saturated by a tenderness I hadn't felt since my mother died. I don't take well to helplessness. I've worked hard in my life to deny neediness, and there I was, unable to sustain any pretense of toughness or competence. In some ways, it came as a great relief to lie there in a puddle and give myself up to her nurturing. By the time she'd finished checking me, I was somewhat more alert, anxious to get my bearings. I quizzed her in a foggy way, trying to get a fix on my current state. She told me I was in a private room at St. Terry's, having been admitted through emergency the night before. I remembered in fragments some of it. The high keening of sirens as the ambulance swayed around corners, the harsh white light above me in the emergency room, the murmurs of the medical personnel assigned to evaluate my injuries. I remembered how soothing it was when I was finally tucked into bed, clean, patched up, pumped full of medications and feeling no pain. It was now mid-morning of New Year's Day. I was still groggy, and I discovered belatedly that I was dropping off to sleep without even being aware of it. The next time I woke, the IV had been removed, and the doctor had been replaced by a nurse's aide who helped me onto the bedpan, cleaned me up again, changed my gown, and put fresh sheets on the bed, cranking me into a sitting position so I could see the world. It was nearly noon. I was famished by then and wolfed down a dish of cherry jello the aide rustled up from somewhere. That held me until the meal carts arrived on the floor. Daniel had gone down to the hospital cafeteria for lunch, and by the time he got back, I'd requested a no-visitors sign hung on the door. The restrictions must not have applied to Lieutenant Dolan, however, because the next thing I knew, he was sitting in the chair, leafing through a magazine. He's in his 50s, a big, shambling man with scuffed shoes and a lightweight beige suit. He looked exhausted from the horizontal lines across his forehead to his sagging jawline, which was ill-shaved. His thinning hair was rumpled, he had bags under his eyes, and his color was bad. I had to guess that he'd been out late the night before, maybe looking forward to a day of football games on TV instead of interviewing me. He looked up from his magazine and saw that I was awake. I've known Dolan for maybe 5 years, and while we respect each other, we're never at ease. He's in charge of the homicide detail of the Santa Teresa Police Department, and we sometimes cross swords. He's not fond of private investigators, and I'm not fond of having to defend my occupational status. If I could find a way to avoid homicide cases, believe me, I would.
You awake? He said.
More or less. He set the magazine aside and got up, shoving his hands in his coat pockets while he stood by my bed. All my usual sassiness had been quite literally blown away. Lieutenant Dolan didn't seem to know how to handle me in my subdued state.
You feel well enough to talk about last night?
I think so.
You remember what happened?
Some. There was an explosion, and Olive was killed. Dolan's mouth pulled down.
Died instantly. Her husband survived, but he's blanking on things. Doctor says it'll come back to him in a day or two. You got off light for someone standing right in the path.
Bomb?
Package bomb. Black powder, we think. I have the bomb techs on it now, cataloging evidence. What about the parcel? You see anything?
There was a package on the doorstep when I got there.
What time was that?
4:30, a little bit before. The Kohlers were having a New Year's Eve party, and she asked me to help.
I filled him in briefly on the circumstances of the party.
I could feel myself reviving, my thoughts gradually becoming more coherent.
Tell me what you remember about the parcel.
There isn't much. I only glanced at it once. Brown paper, no string, block lettering done with a magic marker from the look of it. I saw it upside down.
The address facing the door, he said.
He took out a little spiral-bound notebook and a pen.
Right. Who's it sent to?
Terry, I think. Not Mr. and Mrs., because the line of print wasn't that long. Even upside down. I'd have noticed the O in Olive's name. He was jotting notes.
Return address?
I don't remember any postmark either. There might have been a UPS number, but I didn't see one.
You're doing pretty good, he said. The regular mailman says he only delivered hand mail yesterday. No packages at all. UPS had no record of a delivery to that address. They didn't even have a truck in the area. You didn't see anyone leave the premises.
I tried to think back, but I was drawing a blank. Can't help you there. I don't remember anyone on foot. A car might have passed, but I can't picture it. I closed my eyes, visualizing the porch. There were salmon begonias in big tubs along the front. Oh, yeah, the newspaper was on the doormat. I don't know how far up the walk the paper boy comes, but he might have seen the parcel when he was doing his route. He made another note.
We'll try that. What about dimensions?
I could feel myself shrug. Size of a shirt box, bigger than a book. 9 by 12 inches by 3. Was there anything left of it?
More than you'd think. We believe there was gift wrap under the brown mailing paper. Blue.
Oh, sure, I said, startled. I remember seeing flakes of brown and blue. I thought it was snow, but it must have been paper particles. I remembered what Terry had said to me. Something else, I said. Terry was threatened. He talked about it when I was there the night before. He had a phone call at the plant from a woman named Lyda Case. She asked him when his birthday was, and when he told her, she said he shouldn't count on it. I filled him in on the rest, unburdening the sequence of events from the first. For once, I loved offloading the information on him.
This was big time. The heavy hitters. More than I could deal with by myself.
When it came down to bombs, I was out of my league. Lieutenant Dolan was scratching notes at a quick clip, his expression that mask of studied neutrality all cops tend to wear, taking in everything, giving nothing back. He talked as if he was already on the witness stand.
So there's a chance she's in Santa Teresa. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. He seemed to think she was coming out, but he was pretty vague on that point. He's here, too? I asked.
This floor, other end of the hall.
You care if I talk to him?
No, not a bit. Might help jog his memory.
After Lieutenant Dolan left, I eased into a sitting position on the edge of the bed, feet dangling over the edge. My head was pounding at the sudden exertion. I sat and waited for the light show inside my head to fade. I studied as much of my body as I could. My legs looked frail under the lightweight cotton of the hospital gown, which tied at the back and let in lots of air. The pattern of bruises across my front looked like someone had taken a powder puff and dusted me with purple talc. My hands were bandaged, and I could see an aura of angry red flesh along my inner arms, where the burns tapered off. I held on to the handrail and slid off the bed, supporting myself on the bed table. My legs were trembling. I could almost bet they didn't want me getting up this way. I didn't think it was such a hot idea myself, the more I thought of it. Nausea and clamminess were chiming in with the pounding in my head, and a fuzzy darkness was gathering along the periphery of my vision. I wasn't going to win an award for this, so I sat back down. There was a tap at the door, and the nurse came in.
"Your husband's out here. He says he has to leave, and he'd like to see you before he goes."
"He's not my husband," I said automatically.
She put her hands in the pockets of her uniform, a tunic over white pants, no cap. I only knew she was a nurse because her plastic name tag had an RN after her name, which was Sherry Wright. I studied her covertly, knowing how much Daniel liked women with names like that. Debbie and Tammy and Cindy. Candy loomed large in there, too. I guess Kinsey qualified, now that I thought of it.
Kinsey. K-I-N-S-I-E.
Infidelity reduces and diminishes, leaving nothing where you once had a sense of self-worth.
"He's been worried sick," she said. "I know it's none of my business, but he was here all night. I thought you should be aware."
She saw that I was struggling to get settled in the bed, and she gave me a hand. I guessed that she was 26. I was 23 when I married him, 24 when he left. No explanation, no discussion. The divorce was no fault, served up in record time.
"Is there a way I can get a wheelchair? There's someone down the hall I'd like to see, the man who was admitted at the same time I was."
"Mr. Kohler. He's in 306 at the end of the hall."
"How's he doing?"
"Fine. He's going home this afternoon."
"The policeman who was here a little while ago wants me to talk to him."
"What about your husband? He said it would only take 2 minutes."
"He's not my husband," I said, parrot-like. "But sure. Send him in. After he goes, could you find me a wheelchair? If I try to walk, I'll fall on my puss and have to sue this outfit."
She didn't think I was amusing, and she didn't like the reference to lawsuits. She went out without a word. My husband, I thought. I should live so long. Chapter 16. He looked tired. An improvement, I thought. Daniel stood by my hospital bed, showing every minute of his 42 years.
"I know this won't sit well with you," he said. "But the doctor says she won't let you go home unless you have someone to look after you."
A feeling very like panic crept up in my chest.
"I'll be fine in a day. I don't need anyone looking after me. I hate that idea."
"Well, I knew you would. I'm telling you what she said. She didn't mention it to me." "She never had a chance. You were half zonked. She said she'd talk to you about it next time she made her rounds."
"They can't keep me here. That's disgusting. I'll go nuts."
"I already told her that. I just wanted you to know I'd be willing to help. I could get you signed out of here and settled at home. I wouldn't actually have to stay on the premises. The place of yours looks too small for more than one person anyway. But I could at least check on you twice a day, make sure you have everything you need."
"Let me think about it," I said grudgingly. But I could already see the bind I was in. With Henry gone, Rosie on vacation, and Jonah out of town, I'd be on my own. Truly, I wasn't feeling that good. I just couldn't make my body do what I wanted it to. The elderly, the feeble, and the infirm must experience the same exasperation and bewilderment. For once, my determination had nothing whatever to do with my proficiency. It was exhausting to sit up, and I knew perfectly well I couldn't manage much at home. Staying here was out of the question. Hospitals are dangerous. People make mistakes. Wrong blood, wrong medication, wrong surgeries, wrong tests. I was checking out of this place toot sweet.
Daniel ran his hand across the top of my head.
"Do what you want. I'll be back later."
He was gone again before I could protest. I buzzed the nurse's station on the intercom. A hollow voice came on.
"Yes?"
"Can Mr. Kohler in 306 have visitors?"
"As far as I know, he can."
The nurse sounded like she was talking into an old tin can, coughs and rustling in the background. "Can I get a wheelchair? I'd like to go down and see him." It was 20 minutes before anybody managed to find me one. In the meantime, I became aware that I was struggling with a depression generated by Olive's death. It wasn't as if we had had a relationship, but she'd been around on the borders of my life for years. I'd first seen her in high school when I met Ashley, but she'd left just before our junior year began. After that, she was more rumor than fact. The sister who was always off somewhere else, boarding school, Switzerland, skiing in Utah with friends. I don't think we'd exchanged more than superficial chat until 2 days before, and then I'd found my opinion of her undergoing a shift. Now death had smashed her like a bug, the blow as abrupt as a fly being swatted on a windowsill. The effect was jarring, and the emotional impact hadn't worn off. I found myself turning images in my mind, trying to absorb the finality. I hadn't been consulted in the matter, and I hadn't agreed. Death is insulting, and I resented its sudden appearance like an unannounced visit from a boorish relative. I suspected the knot in my chest would be there for a long time. Not grief per se, but a hard fist of regret. I wheeled myself down the corridor to room 306. The door was closed, and Bass was standing in the hall. He turned his head idly as I approached. Bass had the smooth, good looks of someone in an 18th-century oil painting. His face was oval, boyish, his brow unlined, his eyes a barren brown. His mouth was sensual, his manner superior. Put him in a satin vest, a waistcoat, breeches, and leggings, and he might have been Blue Boy, grown slightly decadent. His hair was fine and dark, receding at the temples, worn slightly long and rather wispy where it gathered in a point on his forehead. He should have had an Afghan at his side, some creature with silky ears and a long aristocratic snout.
"Hello, Bass. I'm Kinsey Milhone. Do you remember me?"
"Of course," he said. He bent down then and gave my cheek a social buss, more noise than contact. His expression was bleak. There was a dead time in the air, one of those uncomfortable, stretched moments when you struggle to find something to say. His sister was dead. This was hardly the time for effusiveness, but I was puzzled by the awkwardness of our encounter.
"Where's Terry?"
He glanced at the door.
"He's having his dressing changed. They should be done shortly. He's going home as soon as the doctor signs the release. How are you? We heard you were down the hall."
"I'm all right." "I'm sorry about Olive," I said, and I truly was.
"God, this is all so screwed up. I don't know what's going on. How's your mother doing? Is she holding up all right?" "She'll be okay. She's a tough old bird. She's taking it pretty hard, but she's got a spine of steel. Ash is destroyed. She's been leveled. She and Olive were always just like this," he said, holding up crossed fingers. "What about you? You look like you took a beating." "I'm all right. This is the first time I've been out of bed, and I feel like shit."
"You're lucky to be alive, from what I hear."
"Lucky is right. I thought about picking the package up myself, but Olive's car pulled in, and I went to help her with the groceries instead."
"Are you staying at your mother's?"
He nodded.
"I got in Thursday night, and then Olive called yesterday and said she was putting the party together. Seems like years ago. I was having a swim before I got dressed when Ebony showed up at the side of the pool. I couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. You know Eb, always in control, never a hair out of place. Well, she looked like a wild woman. I pulled myself up on the side of the pool, and she said a bomb had gone off at Olive's house and she was dead. I thought she was making the whole thing up. I laughed. It was so far-fetched, I couldn't help myself. She slapped the shit out of me, and that's when I realized she was serious."
"What happened? Terry can't remember, and the police won't tell us much."
I told him what I could, omitting the gruesome details of Olive's injuries. Even talking about it made me shake. I clamped my teeth shut, trying to relax.
"Sorry," I said.
"It's my fault. I shouldn't have brought it up," he said.
I didn't mean to put you through it all over again. I shook my head. That's fine. I'm okay. Nobody's told me much either. Honestly, I think it helps. The blanks are frustrating.
I was looking for a narrative thread to hang fragments on. I'd lost the night. Everything from 4:30 on had been deleted from my memory bank. He hesitated for a moment and then filled me in on events from his end. Ash had left. She was on her way to Olive's to help set up for the party. As soon as he heard about the explosion, he pulled some clothes on and he and Ebony jumped in the car. They arrived to find Terry being loaded into the ambulance. I was being bundled onto a stretcher, semi-conscious. Olive was still lying near the shrubs, covered by a blanket. Bass's recital of events was flat, like a news report. He was calm, his tone impersonal. He made no eye contact. I stared down the hall where a doctor with a somber expression was talking to an older couple sitting on a bench. The news must have been bad because the woman clutched and unclutched the purse in her lap. I remembered then that I had seen Bass, one of the faces scrutinizing mine, bobbing above me like a balloon on a string. By then shock had set in, and I was shivering uncontrollably in spite of the blankets they'd wrapped me in. I didn't remember Ebony. Maybe they had kept her out by the road, refusing to let her any closer to the carnage. The bomb had made tatters of Olive's flesh. Hunks of her body had been blown against the hedges like clots of snow. I put a hand against my face, feeling flushed with tears. Bass patted me awkwardly, murmuring nonsense, upset that he'd upset me, probably wondering how to get out of it. The emotion passed, and I collected myself, taking a deep breath.
What about Terry's injuries?
Not bad. A cut on his forehead. Couple of cracked ribs where the blast knocked him into the garage. They wanted him for observation, but he seems okay.
There was activity behind us, and the door to Terry's room opened. A nurse came out bearing a stainless steel bowl full of soiled bandages. She seemed enveloped in aromas of denatured alcohol, tincture of iodine, and the distinctive smell of adhesive tape.
You can go in now. Doctor said he can leave any time. We'll get a wheelchair for him when he's ready to go down.
Bass went in first. I wheeled myself in behind. A nurse's aide was straightening the bed table where the nurse had been working. Terry was sitting on the edge of the bed, buttoning up his shirt. I caught sight of his taped ribs through the loose flaps of his shirt, and I looked away. His torso was stark white and hairless, his chest narrow and without musculature. Illness and injury seemed so personal. I didn't want to know the details of his frailty. He looked battered, with a dark track sketched along his forehead where the stitches had been put in. One wrist was bandaged, from cuts perhaps, or burns. His face was pale, his mustache stark, his dark hair disheveled. He seemed shrunken, as if Olive's death had diminished him. Ebony appeared in the doorway, taking in the scene with a cursory glance. She hesitated, waiting for the aide to finish. The room seemed unbearably crowded. I needed fresh air.
"I'll come back in a minute," I murmured. I wheeled myself out.
Ebony followed me as far as the visitor's lounge, a small alcove with a green tweed couch, two matching chairs, an artificial palm, and an ashtray. She took a seat, searching through her handbag for her cigarettes. She lit one, sucking in smoke as if it were oxygen. She looked totally composed, but it was clear that the hospital atmosphere unsettled her. She picked a piece of lint from the lap of her skirt.
"I don't understand any of this," she said harshly. "Who'd want to kill Olive? She never did anything."
Olive wasn't the target. It was Terry. The package with the bomb in it was addressed to him. Ebony's gaze shot up to mine and hung there. A pale wash of pink appeared in the dead white of her face. The hand with the cigarette gave a lurch, almost of its own accord, and cigarette ash tumbled into her lap. She rose abruptly, brushing at it.
"That's ridiculous," she snapped. "The police said there was nothing left of the package once the bomb went off."
She stubbed the cigarette out.
"Well, there was," I said. "Besides which, I saw it. Terry's name was printed on the front, not hers."
"I don't believe it."
A wisp of smoke drifted up from the crushed cigarette stub. She snatched it up again, working the live embers out with her fingertips. She was shredding the remains of the cigarette. The strands of raw tobacco seemed obscene.
"I'm just telling you what I saw. Olive could have been the target, but the package was addressed to him."
"Bullshit! That bastard!
Don't tell me Olive died because she picked it up instead of him."
Her eyes suffused with tears, and she struggled for control. She got up, pacing with agitation. I turned the wheelchair slightly, tracking her course.
"What bastard, Ebony? Who are you referring to?"
She sat down abruptly, pressing the butts of both palms against her eyes.
"No one, I'm sorry. I had no idea. I thought someone meant to kill her, which was horrible enough. But to die by mistake, my God! At least she didn't suffer. They swear she died instantly."
She sobbed once. She formed a tent of her hands, breathing hard into her palms.
"Do you know who killed her?" "Of course not, absolutely not. What kind of monster do you think I am? My own sister."
Her tone of outrage fell away, and she wept earnestly. I wanted to believe her, but I couldn't be sure. I was tired, too close to events to sort out the false from the true. She lifted her face, which was washed with tears.
"Olive said she wasn't going to vote with you," I said, trying the possibility on her for size. "You're such a bitch," she screeched at me. "How dare you? Get away from me!"
Bass appeared in the archway, his gaze turning to mine quizzically. I jammed backward on the push rim, pivoting in the wheelchair. I propelled myself down the corridor, passing a room where someone was calling for help in a low, hopeless tone. A clear plastic tube trailed from under the sheet to a gallon jug of urine under the bed. It looked like lemonade. Olive usually brought the mail in. I'd seen her toss it on the hall table carelessly the day before. She might have been the intended victim, even if the package was addressed to him. I really couldn't remember what she told me about who she was siding with in the power play between Ebony and Lance. Maybe he did it as a means of persuading the others to fall in line. Darcy was waiting in my room when I got back.
"Andy's gone," she said.
Chapter 17. I eased myself back into bed while Darcy filled me in on the details. Andy had come whipping into the office at about 10 o'clock the day before. Mac had insisted on keeping office hours until 5 o'clock, despite the fact that it was New Year's Eve day. Andy had a lunch meeting scheduled, as well as a 2 o'clock appointment with one of the company vice presidents. Darcy said Andy was in panic mode. She tried to give him his phone messages, but he cut her dead, hurried into his office, and began to load his personal items into his briefcase, along with his Rolodex. Next thing she knew, he was gone.
"It was too weird for words," she said. "He's never done anything like that before. And why the Rolodex? I'd already been through it, and I didn't find a thing. But what made him think of that?"
"Maybe he's psychic."
"He'd have to be. Anyway, we didn't see him again for the rest of the day, so after work I hopped in my car and drove out to his place."
"You went all the way out to Elton?"
"Well, yeah. I just didn't like his attitude. He really had his undies in a bundle, and I wanted to know what it was about. I didn't see his car parked anywhere near his apartment, so I went up and peeked in his front window. The place was a pigsty, and all the furniture was gone. Maybe a card table in the living room, but that was it."
"That's all he's got," I said. "It looks like Janice took him for a bundle, and she's clamoring for more."
"She can clamor all she wants, Kinsey. The man is gone. His next-door neighbor saw me peering in the window, and he came out and asked me what I was up to. I told him the truth. I said I worked with Andy, and we were worried because he left the office in a snit without telling us what to do about his appointments. This guy claims he saw Andy going down the steps yesterday morning with two big suitcases banging against his legs. This was maybe 9:30, something like that. He must have come straight to the office, packed up his stuff, and taken off. I called his place every couple of hours last night, and again this morning. All I get is his machine."
I thought about it briefly. Did the newspapers carry an account of Olive's death?
"Not till this morning, and he was gone by then."
I could feel a surge of energy, part restlessness, part dread. I pushed the covers back and swung my legs over the side of the bed.
"I've got to get out of here."
"Are you supposed to be up?"
"Sure. No problem. Check the closet and see if Daniel brought me any clothes."
The green cocktail dress was gone, probably dissected by a pair of surgical scissors in the emergency room the night before, along with my tatty underwear.
"It's empty except for this," she said. She held up my handbag.
"Great, we're in business. As long as I've got my keys, I can get some clothes when I get home. I assume you've got a car here."
Can you leave without a doctor's permission?
I got it. She told Daniel I could go as long as he looked in on me, which he said he would.
Darcy studied me uncertainly, probably guessing what I said was part fib.
God, don't worry about it, Darcy. It's not against the law to check out of a hospital. It's not a prison sentence. I'm a volunteer, I said.
What about your bill?
Would you quit being such a stickler? My insurance pays for this, so I don't owe them anything. They've got my address. They'll find me if they need to.
Darcy was clearly unconvinced, but she shrugged and helped me into the wheelchair, pushing me down the corridor toward the elevators. One of the nurse's aides stared at us as we went by, but I gave her a little wave, and she apparently decided she didn't need to concern herself. When we got downstairs, Darcy lent me her coat and left me in the glass foyer while she went to fetch the car. There I sat in my borrowed coat and little paper slippers, handbag in my lap. If my doctor walked by, I wasn't sure what I'd do. People passing through the foyer gave me cursory glances, but nobody said a word. Being sick is bullshit. I had work to do. By 3:15, I was letting myself into my apartment, which already seemed to have the musty smell of neglect. I'd been gone one day, but it felt like weeks. Darcy came in behind me, her expression tinged with guilt when she saw that I was still shaky on my feet. I perched on the couch, momentarily clammy, and then set about getting dressed.
"What next?" she asked.
I was easing into my blue jeans. "Let's go into the office and see if Andy left anything behind," I said. I pulled on a sweatshirt and went into the bathroom, where I brushed my teeth. My reflection in the bathroom mirror showed a face marked by astonishment where my eyebrows used to be. My cheeks looked sunburned. I could see a few scrapes and bruises, but it was no big deal. I kind of liked having frizz across the front where my hair once was. I opened the medicine cabinet and took out my trusty nail scissors. I clipped the tape off my right arm and unwound the gauze, inspecting what was underneath. Looked okay to me. Burns do better in the open air anyway. I took a painkiller just in case, and then waved dismissively at the sight of myself. I was fine. I snagged the file folder I'd made after raiding Andy's trash. I put on some sweat socks and tennis shoes, grabbing a jacket just before I locked up again. Santa Teresa usually gets chilly once the sun goes down, and I wasn't sure how long I'd be gone. Outside it felt more like August than January. The sky was clear, the sun high overhead. There was no breeze at all, and the sidewalks were functioning like solar panels, absorbing the sunlight, throwing off heat. There was no sign of Daniel, for which I was grateful. He would no doubt have disapproved of my hospital defection. I spotted my little VW parked two doors down, and I was glad somebody'd had the foresight to drive it back to my place. I wasn't up to driving yet, but it was nice to know the car was there. Darcy drove us over to the office. There was scarcely any traffic. The whole downtown area seemed deserted, as if in the wake of nuclear attack. The parking lot was empty except for a series of beer bottles clustered near the kiosks, the dregs of a New Year's Eve revelry. We went up the back stairs. "You know what bothers me?" I asked Darcy as we climbed. She unlocked the door to the building, glancing back at me.
"What's that?"
"Well, suppose we assume Andy's guilty of conspiracy in this. It does look that way, even though we don't have proof at this point, right?"
"I'd say so."
"I can't figure out why he agreed to do it. We're talking major insurance fraud. He gets caught. It's his livelihood. So what's in it for him?"
"It has to be a payoff," Darcy said. "If Janice hosed him, he's probably desperate for cash."
"Maybe," I said. "It means somebody knew him well enough to think he'd tumble to a bribe. Andy's always been a jerk, but I never really thought of him as dishonest."
We'd reached the glass doors of California Fidelity.
"What are you saying?"
she asked as she unlocked the door and let us in. She flipped the overhead lights on and tossed her handbag on a chair.
"I don't really know. I'm wondering if something else was going on, I guess. He's in a perfect position to fiddle with the claim forms, but it's still a big risk. And why the panic? What went wrong?"
"He probably didn't count on Olive getting killed. That's got to fit in somewhere," she said.
We went into Andy's office. Darcy watched with interest as I went through a systematic search. It looked like his business files were still intact, but all of his personal effects had been removed. The photograph of his kids that had sat on his desk, his leather-bound appointment calendar, address book, Rolodex, even the framed APS-CRAP and MDRT awards he'd gotten some years before. He'd left a studio portrait of Janice, a 5x7 color headshot showing bouffant blonde hair, a heart-shaped face, and a pointed chin. She did have a spiteful look about her, even grinning at the camera. Andy had blackened one front tooth and penned in some handsome hairs growing out of her nose. By widening her nostrils slightly, he'd created a piggy effect. The ever-mature Andy Motyka expressing his opinion of his ex-wife. I sat in his swivel chair and surveyed the place, wondering how I was going to get a line on him. Where would he go, and why take off like that? Had he made the bomb? Darcy was quiet, not wanting to interrupt my thought processes, such as they were. "You have a number for Janice?" I asked. "Yeah, at my desk. You want me to call and see if she knows where he is?" "Let's do that. Make up an excuse if you can, and don't give anything away. If she doesn't know he's skipped out, let's don't tip it at this point."
"Right," Darcy said.
She moved out to the reception area. I picked up the file I'd brought and pulled out all the papers. It was clear that Andy was in serious financial straits. Between Janice's harangue over the late support check and the pink and red-rimmed dunning notices, it was safe to assume that the pressure was on. I reread the various versions of his love letter to his inamorata. That must have been quite a Christmas Eve they'd had. Maybe he'd run away with her. Andy's calendar pad still sat at the uppermost edge of his blotter, two date sheets side by side, connected by arched clips that allowed the pages to lie flat. He'd taken his leather month-by-month appointment book, but he'd left this behind. Apparently he made a habit of noting appointments on both places so his secretary could keep track of his whereabouts. I leafed back through the week day by day. On Friday, December 24th, he'd circled 9 o'clock p.m. and penciled in the initial L. Was this his beloved? I worked my way back through the last 6 months. The initial cropped up at irregular intervals with no pattern that I could discern. I went out to the reception area, taking the calendar pad and the file folder with me. Darcy was on the phone in the midst of a chat with Janice, from what I gathered.
"Uh-huh. Well, I wouldn't know anything about that. I don't know him all that well." "Uh-huh. What's your attorney telling you?" "I guess that's true, but I don't know what good it would do you. Look, I'm going to have to run, Janice. I've got somebody standing here waiting to use the phone." "Uh-huh. I'd appreciate that, and I'll let you know what we hear on this end. I'm sure he just went off for the weekend and forgot to mention it. Thanks much. You too. Bye-bye. Right."
Darcy replaced the receiver and let out a deep breath.
"Good God, that woman can talk. It's lucky I called when I did, because I got an earful. She's PO'd. He was supposed to come by last night and pick the kids up, and he never showed. She was all set to go out and had to cancel her plans. No call, no apologies, nothing. She's convinced he's skipped town, and she's all set to call the cops."
"Wouldn't do any good unless he's been missing 72 hours, I said. "He's probably shacked up somewhere with this bimbo he's so crazy about." I showed Darcy the letters I'd picked out of his trash. It was wonderful watching her expression shift from amusement to distaste.
"Oh, God! Would you let him suckle your oomph-oomph?"
"Only if I doused it with arsenic first." Darcy's brow wrinkled.
"Her bazookas must be huge. He couldn't think what to compare 'em to."
I looked over her shoulder. "Well, footballs, but he crossed that out. Probably didn't seem romantic." Darcy shoved the papers back in the file.
"That was titillating stuff. Oh, bad joke. Now what?"
"I don't know. He took his address book with him, but I do have this." I flipped through the calendar pad and showed her the penciled initials scattered through the months. I could see Darcy's mental wheels start to turn.
"Wonder if she ever called him here," she said. "She must have, don't you think?"
She opened her top right-hand desk drawer and took out the log for incoming telephone calls. It was a carbonless system with a permanent record in yellow overlaid by white perforated originals. If a call came in for someone out of the office, she made a note of the date and time, the caller, and the return number, checking off one of the responses to the right. Please call, will call back, or message. The top slip was then torn out and given to the relevant recipient. Darcy turned back to December 1st.
"It didn't take us long to find her."
By comparing the log of Andy's calls with a calendar pad, we came up with one repeat caller who left a number but no name, always a day or two prior to Andy's assignations, if indeed that's what they were.
"Do you keep crisscross around here?" I asked.
"I don't think so. We used to have one, but I haven't seen it for months."
"I've got last year's in my office. Let's see who's listed at this number. We better hope it's not a business."
I pulled my keys out of my handbag as Darcy followed me.
"You were supposed to turn those keys in," she said in mild reproof.
"Oh, really? I didn't know that."
I unlocked my office door and moved to the file cabinet, pulling the crisscross from the bottom drawer. The number, at least the year before, belonged to last name Wilding, first name Lorraine.
"You think it's her?" Darcy asked.
"I know a good way to find out," I said.
The address listed was only 2 blocks from my apartment, down near the beach.
"Are you sure you're okay? I don't think you should be running around like this."
"Don't sweat it. I'm fine," I said.
The truth was, I wasn't feeling all that terrific, but I didn't want to lay my little head down until a few questions had been answered first. I was running on adrenaline, not a bad source of energy. When it ran out, of course, you were up shit creek, but for the time being it seemed better to be on the move.
Chapter 18.
I had Darcy drop me off. In an interview situation, I prefer to work alone, especially when I'm not quite sure who I'm dealing with. People are easier to manage one-on-one. There's more room to ad lib and more room to negotiate. The apartment building was Spanish style, probably dating from the 30s. The red tile roof had aged to the color of rust, and the stucco had mellowed from stark white to cream. There were clumps of beaky-looking bird-of-paradise plants in front. A towering 60-foot pine tree enveloped the yard in shade. Bougainvillea was massed at the roofline, a tumble of magenta blossoms that spread out along the gutters and trailed like Spanish moss. Wood shutters, painted dark brown, flanked the windows. The loggia was chilly and smelled of damp earth. I knocked at apartment D. There was no sign of Andy's car in the street, but there was still a possibility that he was here. I had no idea what I'd say if he appeared at the door. It was nearly 6 o'clock, and I could smell someone's supper in the making, something with onions and celery and butter. The door opened, and I felt a little lurch of surprise. Andy's ex-wife was staring out at me.
"Janice?" I said with disbelief.
"I'm Lorraine," she said. "You must be looking for my sister."
Once she spoke, the resemblance began to fade. She had to be in her mid-40s, her good looks just beginning to dehydrate. She had Janice's blonde hair and the same pointed chin, but her eyes were bigger and her mouth was more generous. So was her body. She was my height, probably 10 pounds heavier, and I could see where she carried the excess. Her eyes were brown, and she'd lined them with black, adding false lashes as dense as paintbrushes. She wore snug white twill shorts and a halter top. Her legs had been shapely once, but the muscles had taken on that stringy look that connotes no exercise. Her tan looked like the comprehensive sort you acquire at a tanning salon, the electric beach. Andy must have been in heaven. I've known men who fall in love with the same type of woman over and over again, but the similarities are usually not so obvious. She looked hauntingly like Janice. The difference was that Lorraine was voluptuous where the former Mrs. Motika tended toward the small, the dry, and the mean. Judging from Andy's letter, Lorraine was freer with her affections than Janice ever was. She did things to him that made his syntax turn hiccups. I wondered if his affair with Lorraine came before or after his divorce. Either way, the liaison was dangerous. If Janice found out about it, she would extract a pretty price. It crossed my mind briefly that someone might have used this as leverage to secure his cooperation. "I'm looking for Andy," I said.
"Who?"
"Andy Motika, your brother-in-law. I'm from the insurance company where he works."
"Why, look at me. He and Janice are divorced."
"He gave me this address in case I ever needed to get in touch."
"He did?
Why else would I be here?" She looked at me with suspicion.
"How well do you know Janice?"
I shrugged. "I don't really. I used to see her at company parties before they split. When you first opened the door, I thought it was her. You look so much alike." She took that in and digested it.
"What do you want Andy for?"
"He disappeared yesterday, and no one seems to know where he went.
Did he say anything to you?
Not really. Mind if I come in? Maybe we can figure what's happening.
All right, she said reluctantly. I suppose that's okay. He never told me he gave anyone this address.
She stepped back, and I followed her into the apartment. A small tiled entry dropped down two steps into a large living room. The apartment looked as if it had been furnished from a rental company. Everything was new, handsome, and impersonal. A foot-high live spruce decked with candy canes sat on the glass and brass coffee table, but that was the only indication that Christmas had come and gone. Lorraine flicked the television off and motioned me to a chair. The upholstery had the tough, rubbery feel of scotch guarding. Neither tears, blood, nor spilled booze could penetrate such a finish. She sat down, giving the crotch of her shorts a pull so the inseam wouldn't bury itself in her private parts.
"How'd you say you know Andy? Do you work for him?"
"Not really for him, but the same company. When did you see him last?"
3 days ago. I talked to him on the phone, Thursday night. He was taking his kids on New Year's Eve, so I wasn't going to see him till late tomorrow anyway, but he always calls regardless of what's going on. When I didn't hear by this morning, I drove out to his place, but there's no sign of him. Why would you need him New Year's Day?"
I stuck as close to the truth as I could, filling her in on the fact that he'd departed Friday morning without giving any indication where he meant to go. "We need one of the files. Do you know anything about the claim he was working on? There was a fire out at Wood Warren about a week ago, and I think he was doing some of the paperwork." There was a startled silence, and the barrier shot up again.
"Excuse me?"
"Did he mention that to you?"
"What did you say your name was?"
"Darcy. I'm the receptionist. I think I've talked to you a couple of times on the phone." Her manner became formal, circumspect.
"I see. Well, Darcy, he doesn't talk to me about his work. I know he loves the company, and he's fine at what he does."
"Oh, absolutely," said I. "And he's very well liked, which is why we were concerned when he went off without a word. We thought maybe some kind of family matter came up. He didn't say anything about going out of town for a few days?"
She shook her head.
Judging from her attitude, I was almost certain she knew about the scam. I was equally certain she'd never give a hint of confirmation. She said,
"I wish I could help you, but he never said a word to me. In fact, I'd appreciate a call myself when the man turns up. I don't like to have to sit here and fret."
"I don't blame you," I said. "You can reach me at this number if you need to, and I'll check back with you if I hear anything." I jotted down Darcy's name and my telephone number.
"I hope nothing's wrong."
This seemed like the first sincere comment she'd made.
"I'm sure not," I said. Personally, I was betting something had scared the hell out of him and he'd taken off.
She'd had a few minutes now to focus on my browless, burned face.
I hope this doesn't seem rude, but were you in some kind of accident?"
"A gas heater blew up in my face," I said. She made some sympathetic noises, and I hoped the lie wouldn't come back to haunt me.
"Well, I'm sorry I had to bother you on a holiday. I'll let you know if we hear from him."
I got up, and she rose as well, crossing with me to the front door. I walked home through streets beginning to darken, though it was not quite 5 o'clock. The winter sun had sunk, and the air temperature was dropping with it. I was exhausted, secretly wishing I could check back into the hospital for the night. Something about the clean white sheet seemed inviting. I was hungry, too, and for once would have welcomed something more nutritious than peanut butter and crackers, which was what I was looking forward to. Daniel's car was parked at the curb out in front of my apartment. I peered in, half expecting to find him asleep on the back seat. I went in through the gate and around the side of the building to Henry's backyard. Daniel was sitting on the cinder block wall that separated Henry's lot from our neighbors to the right. Daniel, his elbows on his knees, was blowing a low, mournful tune on an alto harmonica. With the cowboy boots, the jeans, and a blue denim jacket, he might have been out on the range.
"About time you got home," he remarked.
He tucked the harmonica in his pocket and got up.
"I had work to do."
"You're always working. You should take better care of yourself."
I unlocked my front door and went in, flipping on the light. I slung my handbag on a chair and sank down on the couch. Daniel moved into my kitchenette and opened the refrigerator.
"Don't you ever grocery shop?"
"What for? I'm never home."
"Lord."
He took out a stub of butter, some eggs, and a packet of cheese so old it looked like dark plastic around the edge.
While I watched, he searched my kitchen cabinets, assembling miscellaneous foodstuffs. I slouched down on my spine, leaning my head against the back of the couch with my feet propped up on the ottoman. I was fresh out of snappy talk, and I couldn't conjure up a shred of anger. This was a man I'd loved once, and though the feelings were gone, a certain familiarity remained.
"How come this place smells like feet?" he said idly.
He was already chopping onions, his fingers nimble. He played piano the same way, with a careless expertise.
"It's my air fern. Somebody gave it to me as a pet."
He picked up the tag end of a pound of bacon, sniffing suspiciously at the contents.
"Stiff as beef jerky."
"Lasts longer that way," I said. He shrugged and extracted the three remaining pieces of bacon, which he dropped into the skillet with a clinking sound.
"God, one thing about giving up dope. Food never has tasted right," he said. "Smoke dope, you're always eating the best meal you ever had. Helps when you're broke or on the road."
"You really gave up the hard stuff?"
"Afraid so," he said. "Gave up cigarettes, gave up coffee. I do drink a beer now and then, though I notice you don't have any. I used to go to AA meetings 5 times a week, but that talk of a higher power got to me in the end. There isn't any higher power than heroin, you can take my word for it."
I could feel myself drifting off. He was humming to himself, a melody dimly remembered that blended with the scent of bacon and eggs. What could smell better than supper being cooked by someone else? He shook me gently, and I woke to find an omelet on a warmed plate being placed in my lap. I roused myself, suddenly famished again. Daniel sat cross-legged on the floor, forking up eggs while he talked.
"Who lives in the house?"
"My landlord, Henry Pitts. He's off in Michigan."
"You got something going with him?"
I paused between bites. "The man is 81.
"He have a piano?"
"Actually, I think he does. An upright, probably out of tune. His wife used to play."
"I'd like to try it if there's a way to get in. You think he'd care?"
"Not at all. I've got a key."
"You mean tonight?" "Tomorrow. I gotta be somewhere in a bit."
The way the light fell on his face, I could see the lines near his eyes. Daniel had lived hard, and he wasn't aging well. He looked haggard, a gauntness beginning to emerge.
"I can't believe you're a private detective," he said. "Seems weird to me."
"It's not that different from being a cop," I said. "I'm not part of the bureaucracy, that's all. Don't wear a uniform or punch a time clock. I get paid more, but not as regularly."
"A bit more dangerous, isn't it? I don't remember anyone ever tried to blow you up back then."
"Well, they sure tried everything else. Traffic detail, every time you pull someone over, you wonder if the car's stolen, if the driver's got a gun. Domestic violence is worse. People drinking, doing drugs. Half the time, they just as soon waste you as one another. Knock on the door, you never know what you're dealing with."
"How'd you get involved in a homicide?"
"It didn't start out like that. You know the family, by the way," I said.
"I do."
"The Woods. Remember Basswood?" He hesitated.
"Vaguely."
"His sister Olive is the one who died." Daniel set his plate down.
"The Kohler woman is his sister?" "I had no idea. What the hell is going on?"
I sketched it out for him, telling him what I knew. "If I have a client, I won't talk about a case, but I couldn't see the harm here. Just me. It felt good, giving me a chance to theorize to some extent. Daniel was a good audience, asking just the right questions. It felt like old times. The good times when we talked on for hours about whatever suited us." Finally, a silence fell. I was cold and feeling tense. I reached for the quilt and covered my feet. "Why'd you leave me, Daniel? I never have understood." He kept his tone light.
"It wasn't you, babe. It wasn't anything personal."
"Was there someone else?" He shifted uneasily, tapping with the fork on the edge of his dinner plate. He set the utensil aside. He stretched his legs out in front of him.